The following presentation was recorded at a Faith Builders colloquy. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Briefly on what I called UCS teacher training. That's the school I taught at, United Christian School, teacher training. And I think it's probably common for many Christian schools, although I think in terms of many of our Mennonite Christian schools, I felt that they did a pretty good job in terms of what was going on across the spectrum. What happened in our school was that before you could teach in our school, you had to go for a week of training at the, we used the Becker curriculum in the elementary, and so we had to go for a week of training at down in Pensacola, Florida, in their training program. And they explained curriculum, lots of helpful advice in classroom management, scheduling, discipline, that sort of thing. So a teacher was required to attend that the first year they taught. They could attend every year if they wanted to. We also attended the Association of Christian Schools International conventions, which were a two-day, a one-and-a-half, two-day convention every fall. And those had a wide variety of workshops available and good speakers coming in. And really what those did for us was raise the vision, was really to show people what all is out there in terms of training and teaching and raising the vision, because we too struggle with that idea. Well, I'm single now and I'll teach for a couple of years, then when I get married I'll go on to other things. And so we were able to challenge teachers, say, look, this has God called you to teaching? Is God calling you to be a teacher? We had some outstanding teachers. Not much training, but some outstanding teachers. And by giving them some basic tools, increase their effectiveness. I'm taking more time here. So that was UCS teacher training. And usually what the school tried to do was try to hire a principal who had a broad range of experience and some training, and expect him to filter that down to the teachers. It was a big job, and it can't be done well, but it's better than nothing. And with resources, the economic vacuum you talked about, those are all issues that enter in. Something that we also discussed was the medieval craftsmanship model, where we have a craftsman take on an apprentice. And not so much just doing the 15-week. Something that we enter in here is, and this is just what's happening out there, Bill Gothard's ATIA. I don't know, how many are you familiar with that? A number of you are. So you can maybe explain it better than I could. However, as I understand it, he is, pushing for parents to take and apprentice their children to a local medical doctor and maybe work for him for 10 years, 15 years, and allow him to teach and to train and do the reading along with the hands-on, and maybe in 10, 15 years, take that medical exam and pass it. And there are people doing it. It's pretty outstanding, because they're not going through all the secular influence. And I guess time will tell. The jury's probably still out on how well that's going to work. But it's an interesting project. And it sort of models this medieval craftsmanship thing, where you have people apprenticing to someone who is a specialist in that area and learning from them, and eventually taking the bar exam, taking the medical exam, and doing the internship and doing well. Many of those people are doing an outstanding job in those areas. Jay Adams also has some ideas in his book, Back to the Blackboard. How many have read that? Back to the Blackboard by Jay Adams? He just mentions how so often we have in the classroom this sequestered, cloistered atmosphere where we learn everything in abstract theory, and then we're supposed to go out and apply it. And we haven't been out there applying it. We simply learned it. And you also have, it seems, this natural role of the teacher against the student, rather than the teacher being for the student. And the student feels like he's got to perform for the teacher in order to make the grade, rather than feeling supported and undergirded and pushed and drawn by the teacher. And so he suggests that we have projects rather than courses. And homeschooling, for whatever you think about homeschooling, homeschooling, if it's done well, can be done very well in this area, in that parents take a trip to Virginia, and in the months before they go, they have their children reading on mining and all aspects of the mining industry, how coal is formed, what's done with it after it's mined, how is it mined, who uses it, what's done with it, and studying the whole industry economically all around, and then going and visiting it when they get there. Can you imagine the way they can absorb what they see as they read and observe? And so Jay Adams talks about projects rather than courses. He says a project differs from a course in a number of ways. A course focuses on one aspect of life to the exclusion of others. So if you study logic, you look at logic. If you look at grammar, you look at grammar, but you exclude everything else. And those courses you took, you had profs come in from different fields, and you sort of integrated everything. Very attractive. A good project, on the other hand, is well-rounded and emphasizes many aspects of life at once. Secondly, a course teaches theory in the abstract without application to real life. There's little more at stake than grades. Am I going to get that good grade? And so the principle of learning for use in ministry is totally lacking. You know, in college classes, we sat and talked about, you know, I want to be involved in ministry. Sounds great, doesn't it? You learn to be involved in ministry, but you get out there and you realize you don't have a clue. Oh, you do. But it takes, there's an awful lot to put into shoe leather. It takes a lot of time. A lot of my wonderful ideas that I had when I came in the first year of teaching, went down the tubes, I thought, that first year. You know what? I find they're coming back, but they've been revamped. And that's exciting. It's exciting to me. It wasn't in vain, even though that first year I thought, forget it. It doesn't work. But now it's coming back, and that is exciting. And so that would be something. Now, there's a whole series of questions that I thought of as well, especially in response to some of the questions my professor asked. And I'd like to close with these questions, especially in light of options. Apprenticeship. And what kind of teacher does it take to have this kind of project versus courses? Apprenticeship versus the normal college experience. And so I want to make it practical to faith builders. So I'm going to ask them in terms of faith builders. Why is Faith Builders doing teacher training in this way, the apprenticeship program? Why are we doing it in this way? What is the philosophy and mission of Faith Builders? And we're going to hear more about that from other speakers today, so I won't go on about that. Another question is this approach different from what has been done or better than? Or is it both? Is it just different? Or is it better than something else? Or is it both different and better? In order to answer that, you have to answer another question. What are you going to measure? What are you going to measure to see if it's different from or better than? Are you going to measure teacher performance? Are you going to measure student performance? What are you going to use to measure? You're going to use standardized tests. You're going to look at spiritual influence, personal influence of the teacher and his students. And we have to realize that different is not always better. I'm not being critical. I'm not making a value judgment there. I'm simply saying we need to remember that different is not better. I think it's important, and it's been emphasized today, that we look at history. What has been done? So many ideas in terms of teacher training and education. What has been done? We don't need to reinvent the wheel. Let's not make the same mistakes. You know, someone has said that experience is the best teacher, and you're right. We don't have time. The best experience is evaluated experience. Can we evaluate the experiences we have and use them to save time and to accomplish our mission? Second thing that I think we need to focus on is what do we want to produce? What is the product of our teacher training? I want a teacher. I think the Bible is clear. We want a teacher who has passion, who can teach with his life, with who he is, and not just with what he or she knows. So as we take on this job of teacher training, as we look at our options, as we evaluate what we have to do, let's be faithful. Let's look to the Lord. Allow him to lead us. Thank you.
I think I'm glad to be here today. I share Brother Melvin's reticence in talking about options, especially in teacher training. We'll talk more about that. I also enjoyed immensely Brother Paul's remarks about formal training, stimulating our thinking about that. Is teacher training the work of God? Are teachers important? What makes a good teacher? How do we train people to be good teachers? As I looked over the program for this weekend, I found one important assumption that wasn't really printed on the page. Paul addressed it somewhat. And that is, we know the kind of teacher we want. Is that right? Do we all agree on the results of our efforts in teacher training? Do we know what we want when it's all over, when it's done? Perhaps we do not agree completely. Many different ideas, especially historically, as we'll look at later. And I know the program isn't broad enough. We don't have time to consider all those issues, but I thought that interesting. Consider for a moment the example of Jesus. I find in Luke, as well as in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus aching, longing, perhaps even weeping over his student body as he wept over Jerusalem. I find him also understanding the importance and significance of his role as a teacher in Luke 6:40, when, as in some versions, translations, it says that every student, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. So he knew the significance. I also read in different places that people recognize the power and the authority he had in his teaching. So he was effective as a teacher. And then we also read Nicodemus saying, we know that you are a teacher come from God. A teacher come from God. And then we have the Great Commission in Matthew 28 that says, go and teach all nations. Go and teach. So we have in Jesus a teacher who has passion, has vision. He has a heart for people. He understands his significance and importance in doing God's work. He has power. He's effective. He has authority. He's from God. And he has a mission. He's out to accomplish it. That's the kind of teacher I would like to be. That's the kind of teacher I want for my children. That's the kind of teacher I want in our schools. Jesus taught not only what he knew, but also who he is. He taught with his life. He didn't just simply teach on the intellectual, on the knowledge level. He didn't just cram facts, but he taught with his life. We want to consider this morning some issues in teacher training. And I do certainly invite your input and questions and discussion later on, because I know I will not cover everything there is to cover, and I may not cover it as accurately as some of you perceive. Some of you are far more qualified than I am to be up here. First of all, we'll look at history. What has been done in teacher training? Very briefly there. There's a lot that we could discuss. but what has been done. Secondly, we'll look at what is being done today in the traditional teacher training program. Third, we'll discuss some of the strengths and weaknesses of that traditional approach. And fourth, we'll explore some options we have today. First of all, we'll look at history. I think we do well to look at history, at what has been done, because if you have studied history at all in education, there is this continual flux between tremendous energy and resources being focused on educating people and training people to educate or to train and teach, and times of great darkness. And even today, if you follow the trends, you'll find that even a decade ago, there may have been entirely different emphases in modern education, especially in the public arena. A lot of different emphases, and they change constantly. We need a compass to guide our efforts. We have many outstanding people in history. We have Eli training Samuel, who was a teacher, a prophet. And it is noteworthy to mention that Samuel turned out to be just like his teacher. He did the work of God, but his sons, like Eli's sons, did not follow the ways of God. Elijah, not certain of all the involvement, but he had a school of the prophets. There was a school. There was training taking place, training men to go out and teach others. The Hebrew model, that which went on in ancient Israel, we find in Deuteronomy 6, father and mother were the teachers. Later on, perhaps as a result of a Greek influence, the intertestament period, we have the rabbi synagogue method being taken on. And in ancient Greece and Rome, we had the pedagogue, the old trusted slave who taught boys, especially in the ways of the family, important to, things they needed to know. And we have there in the writings of Plato and Aristotle, you'll find that they considered moral virtue to take primacy over knowledge. Moral virtue was the primary objective of their efforts to train and teach. Quintilian, in his Institutes of Oratory, laid out specific methods telling teachers how to teach in oratory. So we have efforts back then. We could mention Cicero and others. The early church, many schools and monasteries were developed in the first 400 or 500 years after the time of Christ. We have Justin Martyr, who had a school in Rome, a famous quote of his, "Whatever has been uttered aright by any man in any place belongs to us Christians, for next to God we worship and love the Logos, which is from the unbegotten and ineffable God." And he had a school in Rome. Tertullian from Carthage, around 200 AD, in his prescription against heretics, blasted those who championed the teaching methods of Socrates, asking leading questions of inquiry. And he declared, "We have no need for curiosity since Jesus Christ, nor for inquiry since the gospel." However, Augustine of Hippo, around 400 AD, said, "I believe in order that I may understand." He said that faith precedes wisdom and knowledge. Faith precedes wisdom and knowledge. Pope Gregory the Great, in his writing, The Pastoral Care, an extensive work, a manual for pastoral training. We have Alcuin and Charlemagne. Charlemagne made a proclamation to all the abbots of the monasteries in the Holy Roman Empire to add to godly living the teaching of correct speaking and writing. He rebuked them for not teaching the masses to read and write and speak. And Alcuin eventually became the abbot of the most famous school in the Holy Roman Empire, St. Martin's, and was very influential. Peter Abelard had the distinction of replacing his teacher, William of Champeaux, I believe it was, who Peter had a great mind, replaced his teacher. I don't know if that's a nightmare of every teacher or not. The student is smarter than you are. Then we have Thomas Aquinas and the Scholastics. Much could be said there. The Reformers, whose passion it was that everybody be able to read the Bible. That was their passion. That the masses could read. That the plowboy, William Tyndale said, could read the Scriptures. Then we come to John Comenius. Very influential, still known as the father of modern education. He was a Moravian, a very devout, godly man. It was interesting to read about him in secular writings who mentioned the fact that he was a Moravian, and who mentioned the fact of his devoutness, his belief in God. He pioneered a hands-on approach to education. He had a heart for the student. He reacted against the harsh, regimented methods of his day. Other teachers, such as Johann Pestalozzi and Friedrich Froebel and others, came and wanted to know how he taught and modeled. And they also were men who stressed the importance of direct experience in learning, stressed understanding children, stressed appropriate methods of teaching. Comenius wrote the great didactic, School of Infancy, a number of works there, in which he laid out his beliefs about education and training for teachers, had a heavy emphasis on families, training and teaching their children. He wrote about Deuteronomy 6. And he also wrote a section in one of those works, Children, God's Most Precious Gift. And it was rather wrenching to read that later on, because of persecution in his homeland, he saw his own wife and children murdered before his eyes. Went on to roam across Europe, was invited by many different countries to come and evaluate educational systems, come and give input. He was even invited to come to Harvard and be president of Harvard College. Then we go on to the Puritans as they came over to America. And by 1839, we have what was called the normal schools, schools for training teachers. And the need there was that in a lot of the small towns across America, as they were being formed and built, young single people were asked to teach, often young girls. And if once you came through, you were considered able to teach. Sounds familiar. And the need there was just for more training. A lot of things weren't being taught. And there was real need. So normal schools developed and training teachers just in some very basic methods. And today then, skipping across a lot here, we have the modern American university, college, and the accredited teacher training program. Well, that brings us to our second point. What does the modern traditional teacher training program include? And there are essentially three components. You have the content courses, and I would include in there the teacher education courses. We could maybe say there's four components. You have the content course, in other words, you major in biology, or you major in math, or you major in English or music, and you take courses in those subjects called content courses, where you learn that subject thoroughly and you learn it well. You get a strong foundation of the subject. You don't learn everything there is to learn about the subject. You simply get a very strong foundation. And then you take the teacher education courses, and I'll explain those a little bit more. You have field observations. Most colleges, universities require about 100 hours of observation, where you're in the classroom during those 4 years of education. You're in the classrooms in the community around you, and you're observing different things. You have projects. You may be a part of a class project where you go out and you'll look for certain things. Or it may be simply a requirement, as it was in my content area, where I had to get in so many hours of observation in these different areas. I should just explain a little bit. I majored in music at Grace College and in Winona Lake, Indiana. And majored in music education. That meant that I took a core of music courses, and then I also took about 7 courses in teacher education. Also included in that, then, is what is known as internship or student teaching. A practicum, it's where you spend 6 to 9 weeks out in the field with a teacher in your subject area, at least in the secondary. If you're majoring in a secondary major, you're studying to teach high school, and so you spend those weeks with a high school teacher in his classroom, and you begin, my experience was, you begin by observing and just watching, and you talk, and he explains, and you ask questions, and you begin to take half a class time, maybe a whole class time, and you teach a lesson, or you open a class period. For me, in music, it was a little different because we had like 5 or 6 different choirs, and we didn't really have, in the semester I was there, he wasn't teaching a music history course or a music theory course, and so we did, all we did basically was teach choir, and we taught sight singing. And so in terms of content, I didn't have a lot of opportunity to teach that. However, we did a lot with choirs. And the general experience for most students, as I understand it, has been to teach in the content area and hopefully be teaching entire sections of the day, perhaps even a complete day at the end of that term, with your supervising teacher watching and evaluating, as well as college profs coming in periodically and observing and evaluating. It's a challenging time. It's a great time to learn about teaching. Total college hours are usually about 120 class time hours in order to graduate with a degree in teaching. I want to just list some of the courses that are required in a teacher training course. You have principles of education, where you're introduced to the profession of teaching. You have learning experiences. You do some basic observation. You just get out in the classroom, you start watching and listening. And the professor gets you to think about what's involved in teaching, career decisions, student issues, a little bit in the history of education, what has happened. We take a course in educational psychology, which is simply studying how people learn, how people think, how we learn, what factors affect learning. And so they look at theories of learning, look at environment, heredity, cultural impact, discipline, classroom management, gifted students, disabled students. We do a lot of methods courses where you take methods, especially elementary majors, methods of teaching math, methods of teaching reading, methods of teaching language arts. We had a class in the philosophy of education. Why do we do what we do? On what basis? Historical, philosophical foundations of American education. And we study the relationships between one's philosophy of education and his interpretation and analysis of educational aims, problems, and activities. So we look at what people have been thinking about education, what's been said and thought about education ever since the beginning. What's being said today? How does what I believe to be true about the student affect the way I teach the student? Then we look at instructional methods and materials. This is a required course. You have to take it. And you look at techniques to teach elementary and secondary students, and the students required to develop a repertoire of methods and strategies of teaching your subject area. Also, at least 2 weeks of cross-cultural field experience, getting out and looking at Hispanic classrooms and other issues outside of your normal experience. A course entitled Reading in the Content Areas. How to help students read and study in their area. Took a course in educational measurement. How do we measure what we do? In other words, so you teach, if you get up and talk, does that mean you have taught? Or does it mean you've taught if the student has learned something? And how do you measure what he has learned? That's really what that course is all about. How to measure what has been learned and issues in testing. And then, of course, student teaching, which I already described that. Those are some of the basic courses that every teacher has to take. I failed to mention a required course in child development, understanding children. How do they develop? How do their thinking processes develop from ages 0 to 18? How does that take place? Looking now at some strengths and weaknesses of traditional approach, I sat down over lunch with my former professor at the college where I attended, a man who spent a number of years in Christian education, and simply asked him, what do you see as weaknesses and strengths in teacher training today? He's the head of the department there at the college. And we talked about some of those. And I also asked him, if you could design a program, and you have to worry about teacher accreditation. You have to worry about accreditation. If you could design a teacher training program, how would you design it? What would you include? And so we talked about that. Some weaknesses that were mentioned, I'm including my own observations as well as his, but there is not enough intense student involvement. As you go through that experience, my frustration was that I'm cramming all this stuff. And by the end of the 4 or 5 years that I went, I was just, I couldn't wait to get out and start using it. And that's a healthy desire, perhaps, but it was born of frustration at learning, but never using. Not saying that's all bad. That's a tough balance. But it's a weakness that you deal with. There's also a lack of extensive contact with practicing educators. Now, as I look back, and this was a comment of his, as I look back, I thought, I was always in the classroom observing, it seemed. I mean, 100 hours, that's a lot of time. As a student, I never felt I had that much time to sit and watch and observe. But I talked with a lot of teachers. But the extensive contact, sitting down and just talking about what makes a day tough, What makes a teaching enjoyable for you? What works? What doesn't work? What am I learning in college isn't going to help me too much out there? Stanford research says that 85% of what we learn in higher education, we don't use. That's especially true as you get up higher. I'm reminded of Dwayne's. I talked to Brother Dwayne this morning over breakfast, and he said, a former professor of his had a PhD, but loved to go out Saturdays and plow gardens for widows and people. And one, he recalled one morning where he drove past, and it was a cold morning, had gloves on, but the fingers were off, you know, and he was driving his tractor on the road, and he held up his hand and said, "This is life, fellas, this is life." And so there's this lack of extensive contact. Perhaps not enough teaching throughout the learning process where you're being evaluated. Getting out and using it while you're being evaluated by practicing educators. That is something that I would really have appreciated. It's not fun to be on the hot seat, not only with the student, but also with the person sitting and evaluating you. I never enjoyed that. However, looking back, I wish I would have made more of the opportunity. Instead of feeling so threatened by it, wishing I had maximize the experience. Well, some strengths. Some strengths that you have in that situation are the content areas. Studying your major, you get lots of content. You walk in the classroom and you know, you have the confidence that you can probably answer most questions that come up from the student in your content area. I'm not talking about life or the big questions, but I'm talking about questions in your content area. You have the confidence, and that feels good. I don't think in a proud way, but it's the competence that Paul mentioned this morning that brings confidence. I don't think that's a wrong confidence. But there's lots of training in the content areas. Another advantage that my professor mentioned was that the teachers, the teacher trainers, the professors are staying current in the field. Seminars, research, journals, that's part of what they're paid to do, is keep up. And in the smaller universities, they have to teach. Whereas you hear the horror stories in the large universities where you never see the professor that you went to learn from. He's never there. Okay, it's always some graduate student who's teaching the class with no evaluation. And so you never get to benefit directly from that trainer. But in the smaller colleges, you have the benefit of learning under teachers, professors who are staying current. And we discussed, too, the benefit of all the research. I mean, how much research can you keep up on and really utilize? How much of it is really good research? And especially referring back to this continual flux in education. And if the people that are doing the research aren't guided by a compass, you're going to have a lot of flux. We also discussed the question, has good teaching really changed all that much? Has good teaching really changed? And he said, no, not really. It hasn't changed. So this whole idea of research, I think, has its limits, although it keeps us sharp. It keeps us sharp, keeps us thinking, keeps us evaluating and reevaluating why we're doing what we're doing, and that's very beneficial. I've asked three men to share with us this morning from their experience, and I appreciated Paul's comments. I'm not in any way trying to lift up college this morning either. I'm simply trying to communicate what it is, what it includes, and what we have done with it. I'm going to ask Jonas Sauter and Dwayne Tucker and Lamar Kaufman to come and just answer three questions for us this morning. And Dwayne took his teacher training probably 40 years ago, and Jonas said he graduated in 1978. I graduated in 1989, Lamar in 94. So it's kind of a spectrum. And I asked them to answer three questions. We'll answer each question before we go on to the next one. The first one is, what was most helpful in your training in the modern traditional approach? What was most helpful? Second question is, what was the least helpful? And the third one is, if you could add something to your training experience, what would you add if you could add something? Okay, so I'm going to ask them to come in that order. Just if you come up and stand up here, then I'll pass the mic so we can get it on tape. And beginning with Jonas, and then Dwayne, and then Lamar. Perhaps I'll just hold this if you want to stand. Most helpful person. Just answer the question, what was most helpful?
By far, what I found most helpful was the breadth of information. And I think sometimes of the expression of reinventing the wheel. It's really not necessary to reinvent the wheel with each generation. And what I mean by that, I think the thing that impressed me more than anything else over the years of study, and this particularly came out in some integrated studies classes that were offered there, in which they used, this was at Messiah College, where they used teachers from various disciplines as we studied peoples and cultures and ancient ideas and institutions and then the modern time, and studied the scope of history over the years and learned from people from the music department, the art, the history, philosophy, and the sciences. And as each of those people shared on those themes, we got a rounded view, a rounded background. And I was impressed of the questions that have been raised and issues that were raised and answered over the years to give breadth and background and scope, and could see how our modern, especially Western world, and also somewhat of the Eastern, how it has developed and how we have arrived where we are today in our thinking and in the thinking of the larger society. And then, of course, with a Christian perspective given to that, too. So, and in education itself, the foundations course is probably the foundations and the historical background to see where we have arrived, where we are now.
I might mention that even though I began my college career about 40 years ago, I was a break in there for 1W service, and I was a beginning teacher in those years. I'd like to agree with what I've heard today. However, I believe one of the strongest points I remember of my early training was the concern of the teacher for me, that this one-to-one thing. If you had a problem, the classes were not that large, the school was not that large, that you couldn't sort out some qualified person to discuss that problem with you. Also, their feet were, they had their feet on the earth. They were practical people. And as I remember, their ability to convey this shepherd concept that Brother Paul talked about. And I think if I would say there's a weakness in our modern approach with more secular humanism and individualism, then I would see we see people as numbers or people to be driven. Whereas my experience was not that. Especially I had several courses in individual research where I was given a problem or helped to select a problem and had to develop that for teaching. Both of those were in the realm of biology, but it was a matter of developing this problem so that you could teach biology in the high school. In both cases, I was preparing specimens for the museum. I was collecting and that sort of thing, where the teachers were very, very careful to say, now, how will this help you in the classroom? You've cooked off this mouse and you've mounted his bones very nicely, but what's that going to do in the classroom? What difference will it make? Or you've collected these 30 kinds of spiders now and you have them all in these jars and they look very nice, but what difference did it make that you did that? And I think that's still a good problem that I must consider when I face a class. What difference will it make that I'm here? If this class can get along without me, they might as well do it, see. But if there's something I have to offer, now I'm not so sure that the humanistic approach that I've been reading about and studying about later actually contained the warmth of that I did. There's another thing I think we should remember, that the economic things have changed tremendously since when Brother Paul and I were in school. For example, when we walk in the classroom today, using the earning power that we had, we bring $100,000 in the classroom with us. And that's hard to rationalize in terms of a country day school teaching. That the minute the teacher who's prepared from that perspective, it makes it a bit different when a person says, well, I'll hold this job till I get a better one, or the church has to support him anyway, we might as well get some school teaching out of him. Or she says, well, I'll teach a year or two till I get married. And those the whole economic vacuum that looks like a vacuum of our time compared to what is available now. You would say, well, why would anybody want to teach? There was also a proverb brought to my mind when I was in school that has lingered with me. It's a Jewish proverb out of the Talmud. And it states that a father who doesn't teach his son a craft or a trade teaches him to be a thief. So we who were growing up in our context, where you were working your way through the institution to get your learning, you had to learn more than, will the teacher let me off with this? It wasn't quite that easy. You had to do something on your own, again, with your feet on the ground. Perhaps the least important thing of my training would have been the pressure put on to get it done. Some people are very nice. They're like a jet pump. They work with a little pressure. But some of us, that was probably the least important to me, that this must be done by a certain time or else. Well, my farm boy mindset, what's the else? And that doesn't help for learning. But at the same time, I think it's good for me as I look back at it to learn that we must have a framework. Nothing is done in a vacuum. It's in a framework and a context of where we're coming from, what we hope to achieve. The other question, if I could add something.
Can you wait to answer that until I'm doing
okay,
this?
Sure.
Thank you. You can stay up here, though, Duane.
I guess I would say for myself, I taught some before I was ever involved in formal teacher training and also after I was involved in teacher training. And I can say, I think beyond a shadow of a doubt, at least in my experience, that formal teacher training enhanced my teaching by 50, 75, maybe 100%. I don't know. But I appreciated Paul's comments. Certainly isn't maybe always necessary, but I think at least in my experience, it was very, very beneficial. Some of the things that helped me the most, I was fortunate, I guess, in that the school that I went to started out as one of these normal schools. It was an educational school, and even today, there are more education majors than anything else there. And I think, if I remember correctly, the school ranks in the top 10% of the number of teachers that it puts out every year nationwide. So the education program got a lot of emphasis. I think the thing that helped me the most, maybe this is a little different than Brandon's experience, but we did not do a lot of observing. We did teaching. We were required to get out in the classroom quite a bit. Even before student teaching, the semester before, we had to go out for a week at a time in a public school, observe one day, teach 4 days for a certain class. It was getting thrown out in the cold. And along with that comes surviving that brings an awful lot of confidence. So that's one thing that I really appreciated. And also in that experience, in doing that, we would do that, and every time we did that, we would sit down with the teacher after the class and go over what worked, what didn't, what could I have done better. And that was extremely helpful for me. I still remember lots of just practical tips that experienced teachers gave me through those experiences. Things like don't use the same examples in the textbook, use different ones so the students can have a broader perspective on things. Just a lot of little things like that that don't come up in your educational theory classes. They're out there in the practice, and I gain that through those experiences. And along with that, it gave me something to build my portfolio with, projects. I used this past year was my first year that I taught full-time, and I frequently went back to my student teaching material or my college material and drew stuff out that I knew that had worked back there. And I think overall, just the experience of getting out and teaching, it just kind of gives you an edge. I remember a high school teacher telling us, when I was in high school, he said, experience is the best teacher, but life is too short to learn everything by experience. You need some training, too, every once in a while.
Thank you. The next question, what is least helpful? Did you answer? Okay, that's fine. And Jonas, if you would come and answer, what was least helpful?
It may have been interesting. I suppose the least helpful was the RAT class, introductory psych, where we spent some time, seriously this is now, watching a rat in a cage. And as he got to the side, close to where the food was, we pushed the button, and lo and behold, there was a little click, and the pellet came out. And now, since you didn't have the experience, you wouldn't know what a rat would do when you got a pellet food, would you? Well, lest you wonder too much, I'll tell you, the rat ate the food. And then it wasn't too long until he started to spend more time at that side of the cage. And after a while, even though there was no food put out and you clicked the button, guess what the rat did? Well, if you guessed that he went over and checked for food, you're right. Now, I'm not sure if we were reinventing the wheel there or what, but we learned that rats can be trained to spend time at one side of the cage to get look for food. And then we proceeded to extinguish that behavior by clicking, and there was no food there. And after a while, he didn't pay attention to the click anymore. And then, furthermore, we were supposed to, not tongue-in-cheek, seriously, write a paper outlining very carefully our findings, following proper format and footnotes and so on. And now, this would be funny if they weren't being serious about it, you see. And we paid to do this experience, which had been done a number of times before, and probably has been since. Now, I'm glad to say that I didn't have That's one. There were other things that happened in that course besides that that were a bit more value. But that was a foundation course, which is required for the educational psychology course. And we talked about a few of those things briefly, not the rats, but the some of the conclusions and the learning theories this summer in our principles of teaching course. And things like that, some of those theories which have some value can be studied in very short order without duplicating all those activities and spending all that time to do it and writing up the papers to do it. So there are some things like that that, depending on the school that you go to, that you need to take a course or two that might seem worthless like that. And that probably was... I really didn't need to take many courses or classes that I felt were useless. That would have been the closest one. And depending on the program that you get in and depending on the major, there are a number of things that you need to take to fulfill some requirements that really you don't see the practical or even theoretical value of.
I think I can kind of echo what Jonas said. The least helpful experiences were those psychology of learning classes and philosophy of education. Particularly in my case, I went to a secular university. And I don't know if this is true in every college, but I think it's true in a lot of secular institutions, a lot of petty rivalries between different departments. The math department, those involved in the math education in the math department couldn't stand the education profs in the education department. So we had these education classes with the education people, and then we were taught how to teach math with the math people. It would be much more helpful if we'd have applied what we were learning in, say, a psychology of learning or educational foundations to teaching math, for example. And this is not something that I was only feeling myself. This was an attitude that came across with a lot of my classmates, too, that the education courses were just a bunch of I won't repeat the word they used, but they felt it was a waste of time. Whereas if we would have studied, for example, how Bloom's taxonomy relates to teaching algebra, or how Piaget's theories about learning, or what they have to do with geometry or something like that, it would have been much more practical and much more helpful in our experience. The other frustration that I had attending a secular university was we did not get a lot of direction on how to deal with the spiritual and emotional needs of students. We were taught to deal with the symptoms, but we were not taught how to deal with the root problems of disruptive behavior or things like that. And I guess it was a frustration during student teaching as well. There were students that needed help, and yet it wasn't really proper for me to give them the kind of help that they needed in the setting that I was. And along with that, we were... The emphasis, at least in my program, was on professional behavior, not on character development of the teacher. And so I maybe learned how to act like a professional, but the character aspect of teaching, developing character both in yourself and in your students, was lacking.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a comment on that? Sure.
Well, somebody could add. You said I could come back later.
That's fine.
I think there's a realism necessary that must be added. I noticed in both of the remarks of these brothers about their educational courses, I didn't feel that frustration that they felt. My educational courses were well-directed, and we were told why we were doing it. And maybe that made a difference for me. Another thing, maybe I liked rats a little better. Maybe it applied more to biology. Maybe there's a carryover. But the why of it and the realism. Another thing is... what really happens when a teacher teaches? I think somehow this idea has to come across. Not what do you do or what do you look like, but what's going on? And that takes some input from the other side of the desk. And we weren't, even in student teaching, taught to expect a feedback. But I think feedback is necessary. One remark was made earlier today about a man who took his teacher's place. Every teacher should train his replacement, I think, and that should be in our system somewhere. That we are training others to take our place, and we're doing it because we want to do it. You see, the background material, the undergirding, everything that it takes to be the teacher we think we are, you know, we want that person to do it. I found out also later in teaching English as a second language to refugees that even though I thought I knew the English language pretty well, there were a lot of difficulties there because I was speaking American and I was thinking American. And I was not using the rules I expected them to follow to learn the English they needed in our society. And I think that's the same thing when we have people from homes that do not use good English and they come into our schools. We might be trained in English ourselves. And then it's this, that, then, and there, and all those sort of things that we tolerate because we understand what he's trying to say anyway. Did you notice in Brother Mullet's introduction that large amount of history that he included? Did you notice that? I think every teacher should have access to what he was telling us. Because if we don't know where we've come from, we won't know where we're going. And that seems to be sort of the frustration of people pulled in by the ears and put in a classroom and don't know why they're there. Or even some who've chosen to go to certain classrooms where secular humanism is the rule and then they don't know what or how to get out of it. Thank you.
Thank you. The third question then was, if you could add something to your training experience, what would you add? Jonas?
Primarily, much more work in the classroom. I've had several people work with me over the years as student teachers, and doing formal studies and talking about those things after school makes a lot more sense when they are at the same time working in the classroom and can see how those things apply. So from my own experience, I taught 5 years before I went back and finished school, so I could see how many of the things I was learning would apply, but really did not have the experience of working out in the classroom, and very very much at all compared to, I think there's more of a move to that in the last 5-10 years. And then the second thing would be by name, the Christian colleges, for the most part, they really don't have a vision for Christian education in Christian schools. They'll have what they call Christian Education Department, but that is specifically geared to Sunday school teaching. It has nothing to do with Christian education. Anyone who's planning to teach in a Christian school goes through in their education department, which is certified and accredited by a secular or state organization. And at the time when I was there at Messiah, chairman of the, in fact, the dean, academic dean, really had no concept of any courses that ought to be included in the education department that would be any different for teaching in the Christian school and for teaching in the secular. You know, well, okay, so you teach in the Christian school. Well, that would be good. That would be commendable. But there was no concept of integration of faith and learning, no concept of a difference in possibility or mission for the Christian school as opposed to the secular school. So they were primarily attempting to train professing Christians to teach in elementary and high schools, hoping, of course, that they would be Christians, but really with no view of Christian education. That was the second problem I saw.
Again, I'll echo what Jonah said. I think more field experiences, more getting out into the classroom is very helpful. I had a lot of it, but I still could have used a lot more. My student teaching was 15 weeks, and we started out by observing, then take a class and take two classes. Eventually, you're supposed to take the full load for at least 2 weeks. That has changed. I remember talking to a teacher who, in teacher training back in the, I don't know, 50s or 60s, she said, well, they observed one day, and the next day they had the whole thing for the next 15 weeks, which almost felt cheated that I didn't get all that experience, although it would have been a lot more painful. If there could be some way to expand those field experiences, I think it'd be very good. And also, especially if you're going to a large school, like a public school. During my student teaching, I had three sections of the same kind of geometry class. Well, that's okay. I learned how to teach geometry, but it didn't do a lot for teaching algebra too. Somehow make sure that you get a broader variety of teaching experiences, broader variety of classes, and maybe even some classes outside your major would also be helpful. The other thing that I thought about, this probably is a reflection on the university itself, being a secular university, is they didn't teach you how to deal with teacher conflicts and teacher administration conflicts. There's a lot of that out there, especially in the public school and also in Christian schools, unfortunately. But I guess that goes with character development. It would have been nice to have a little more training on how to deal with these problems that come up. Being aware that they will come up is helpful, and then knowing how to deal with them, I think, would have been good to know about.
Thank you. Duane, did you have anything to add? Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking part. And I think they really broadened our perceptions on this particular topic of what the strengths and weaknesses are of the modern traditional teacher training approach. As far as the question about what this department head of a Christian college would add to a program, if you didn't have to worry about accreditation, what would you add? And his comments were insightful and challenging to me, and I'll just share a few of those things. And I would, by the way, from my experience and my frustrations, would echo what he said. He also, I would add this, I mentioned earlier, he was involved in a Christian school administration. He believed in Christian school education. And although he also found it similar to Jonas' experience, that those around him in the institution do not really have a strong conviction or belief about Christian education until it gets to the college level. Up to that point, many of those professors, even the president of the institution, sent his children to public school. Just some of the things that you deal with on that level. Some things he would add. He said he would spend less time in the content areas. Less time. And in the sense that you don't use everything you learn in college, I would agree. However, I'm not sure what all he had in mind. We didn't discuss it at length. My experience has been it felt good to know more because I was better able to couch what I taught in terms of the larger perspective in the subject. You understand what I'm saying? It's tough if you don't understand much beyond what you're teaching. You want that buffer zone just because it helps you teach with greater objectivity and thoroughness with a view to what is more to be learned. He would spend more time in classroom management, and that is simply spending time with what Lamar mentioned, how to manage a classroom. What do you do when a student does this? Now, we spent about 2 hours on this one evening, late in my college experience, in one class. We spent 2 hours on how to deal with specific behaviors in the class. And he acknowledged it. He taught the class. And it was great. My observation about his classes was that everything he talked about out of the text, he modeled. I felt he was a very good teacher. And he sprinkled many of his own experiences in education in with his teaching out of the textbook and in the course. And so it was more than just those 2 hours. I got a lot of good ideas from him just as he related experiences from his own teaching. And so we learned a lot about classroom management, but it was like that. It was informal. It wasn't developed out of a philosophy of the student and then applied in a very practical way. It was not done. And he would spend much more time in classroom management. Scheduling. How do you schedule the day, the week, the year, the curriculum in the classroom? Spend much more time in scheduling, activities, and planning. Family intervention is a big area. And in the first few years I taught, I thought I teach in a very strong community, Christian school. I don't have a big need for that. And in our communities, I don't see the principal, the administrator, as being a real pillar in the community. I didn't see him that way. And I don't think he is as much, especially in our Mennonite communities, because of our Anabaptist view of the brotherhood. We don't hold up one person real high. But I'm finding that as I get out into seminars and Christian school conventions put on by non-Mennonite people, I find that the school administrator is seen almost on a level with the pastor in terms of his counseling opportunities and the needs that are out there, in terms of his example and leadership in the community, charting vision and directing families, training families. You read it in books, you hear it in seminars, where principals are out there sitting down with the family and opening the Bible and talking about marriage. Sitting down with the family, opening the Bible and talking about child training. These are Christian families and Christian schools. And you have administrators doing this kind of family intervention. It's wonderful that they can do it, that it can be done. It's demanding. Time. But I found the longer I taught, I think it was because of my youth, I didn't find, but the longer I taught, by the last year I was there, I was doing much more family intervention. I was amazed in my community. But there's a lot of need there. And I think it needs to be addressed in teacher training, because the teacher has the first contact with that problem. Talk about the stuff of life, you get there as a teacher because you begin to understand why this child behaves as he does. When you begin to understand some things going on at home, you understand mom and dad are having a tough time. And so the child reflects all of that. He's just a mirror. And so there's a little bit of the goldfish bowl effect both ways. You know, as a teacher, you feel like you're in a goldfish bowl. But the family is too. When they send their child to your classroom, we need to respect that and need to be alert to those things. So family intervention was a big part of what he would spend much more time emphasizing if he were to revamp the teacher training program. Well, that brings us to options in teacher training. And how well do they work? You know, my professor said that there's not a lot being done in terms of non-traditional approach. Why? Because of the whole accreditation program. It's pretty much locked in. Everybody's doing it this way. This is how it's designed, set up, and a lot of good things about it. But it doesn't allow for much innovation. And you read about that same problem through history. Same thing happened to the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, who were outstanding. I didn't mention them in the historical part. But they were outstanding in training teachers. They had certain requirements. You had to reach a level of requirements to be a teacher out of their teacher training program. And you had to pass with a certain amount of knowledge and competency under your belt. And they were superior teachers in their day. It was a response to the Reformation, if I understand correctly. And they did an outstanding job. But as time went on, they became irrelevant because they were locked in. And maybe we're seeing a little bit of that happen today. Same thing happened to Erasmus. He championed classical literature, and eventually they became irrelevant. Comenius and others put that aside for more practical things. It's always this debate between the practical and the classical.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.